Welcome back. I'm Henrik. Thank you for being here. Good to have you along for another Red Eyes Radio show. RedEyes.tv is the new website. Today, we're returning back to a topic that we've spent many hours in the past talking about. Freemasonry, their influence behind the scenes of politics, finance, and pretty much everything else. Our guest is Jeff Wilkerson, who's written the book Zion's Army, The Freemasons. In the beginning, we'll talk a bit about his background, so I'll let Jeff introduce himself. But he does have a past in political activism and the National Alliance. We are going to address the secret hand behind Freemasonry and some of the history from its formulation or inception to where it is today, and of course what the agenda is coming out of the top layers of this secret society. Well, Jeff Wilkerson, thank you so much for coming on with us. It's a pleasure to have you here today. I hope you're having a good day where you are.
Oh, yes. Down here in South Florida, it's still dry down here. We have our dry period in the around spring, and then it gets so hot in May and June that it clouds up in the afternoons, and we have our torrential monsoonal downpour.
Yep, that is true. Now, let's talk a bit about how you ended up writing the book. That's kind of the main topic here today. Oh, okay. Jeff, give us some of the background and kind of why you wrote the book.
Okay. Early in the millennial years, like around 2002, 2003, there was a buildup to the war, war in Iraq, and George Bush, our president at the time, was pushing it. And I was very much against this war. I thought it was very stupid. And everybody seemed to be falling in line with what the president was doing. There was a lot of people apprehensive about the war, but a lot of the establishment folks and everything, they seemed to be backing it. Now, let me start. I had been a political activist for quite a while. I would consider myself a white nationalist. I became active in the mid, I graduated from college in the late 70s, and I became active in the mid 80s. I was a member of the National Alliance for about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
I became active in the Populist Party here in America. And, I got more active in the Populist Party, so I dropped my activity in the National Alliance. But I was aware of the Jewish power. I've been in it since the early 80s. And through those years, those 30, 40 something years, things have changed a lot the way I looked at it. When I first got involved in the movement, it seemed to me at least that America had two problems. America had a race problem, and America had a Jewish problem, and that was it. America just had two problems. As time progressed, when we got into the 90s. And also the millennial years, especially, you started hearing about conspiracy theories and conspiracy.
Yep.
And secret societies and that sort of thing. You started seeing the Bill Cooper types in the 90s, Dr. John Coleman, he was another. Of course, in the millennial years, you had advent of InfoWars and Alex Jones, who touches on these topics quite a bit. So there had been a change. But when I got into the movement, it wasn't like that. It just seemed like, we just had two problems. We had a race problem. We had a Jewish problem. Like I said, around the early millennial years, around 2002, 2003, the buildup of the war, I sort of had an epiphany or let's call it an awakening. And I can express it to you. I became aware of conspiracy, and I became aware of secret societies and Freemasons.
I would say as many actually white nationalists, they might consider that many conspiracies. They're kind of kooky and wacky, and you know, stay away from them, etc., whatever. But what was it about that subject that was appealing to you? Because I mean, we've talked about it for years, and to a certain extent, some of the more radical conspiracies is something that we've kind of moved backed off of a little bit. But I still think there's a lot to the subject, of course. But why were you attracted to it?
You know, I like to focus on what really matters, and those things in life that that really have an effect on our lives.
Yeah.
And I became more and more aware that secret societies, conspiracies, in this case, the Freemasons, it was a very important part of the political environment. Now, as I was saying, I was listening to a popular talk show host here in America. Everybody in America has heard of him. You may not have heard of him, Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, sure, of course.
Yeah, very big talk show host. I started listening to him back in the 90s, but I was listening to him in the early millennial years, and he was very much for this war. I mean, he was going at it every day, and I was listening to him, and I couldn't stand this war that we were fixing to get into at the time. And he Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is an imminent threat to America and our way of life, and we must fight this war. And I thought it was just such a stupid war. Now, like I said, I've been listening to Rush Limbaugh since the 90s. And frankly, there was a lot that I went along with what he said. And I agreed, with a lot of what he said. But this war, it seemed like he was on a mission. It seemed like he was he had an agenda. It was really crazy because I couldn't understand it because I was so much against this war. I was tell you a little story here. I was listening about 2 weeks after I had heard Rush Limbaugh. I was listening to another talk show host. Her name was Randy Rhodes, and she was out of New York, and she was liberal. But I listened to her, and the reason I did listen to her was because she was very much against this war. And the topic of conversation this day was, what makes Rush Limbaugh tick? You know, why is he so much for this war? Why, you know, she couldn't understand it. And I was stimulated by the subject because I couldn't understand it either.
Right.
And she got different calls. Somebody called in around halfway through and said, Rush Limbaugh thinks the way he does. Rush Limbaugh, you know, supports this war because he's a Freemason. And the Freemasons have their thumbprints all over this war. And I just started thinking, the light bulb sort of went on in my brain. And I don't want to condemn Freemasons. My father was a Freemason. My brother's a Freemason. My uncles were Freemasons. They're not all bad men, but, I do think they're part of the problem. And, that was an awakening I had sort of an epiphany there. And, I wanted to learn more about Freemasonry. And, I started reading books and, you know, there was a lot of books out there. They fell into either one of two categories. There were, of course, the books that were supportive of Freemasonry. And then there was the books critical of it. They were fewer in number, but they would only go so far.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't really talk about, I was quite radical myself, if you want to use that word. I was a white nationalist. They didn't talk about the real forces behind Freemasonry. And I found a lot of information, but nobody had actually compiled it and put it into a book. And so I decided that's what I was going to do. I was going to write a book, and I did. It took me about 5 years to write it. It's 416 pages. It's sort of an introduction to Freemasonry. Anybody with some education would enjoy my book, and they would be informed. They would be informed as to exactly what Freemasonry is, and you know where it came from. And to a lot of people, it's a mystery.
Yeah, I mean, at the time then, when you were looking into this, if none of the books really dove deep into it, how did you have an understanding of this beforehand, that Freemasonry has a is kind of a, almost like a front group to a different type of agenda, that was that an understanding you had? Yeah. Or was that something you discovered along the way?
Well, I discovered, you know, like with Rush Limbaugh, I that caller called in that day, and it just sort of lit up a light bulb in my brain. I said, you know, there is a hidden hand there. It's not just so simple, you know, a race problem and a Jewish problem. You know, it's just more complicated. There's a hidden hand there. And these secret societies, they work together, and they probably work for the Jews, you know. And that's sort of you know what I started thinking, and I started doing research, and the historical scope of my book is really quite extraordinary.
Yeah.
It starts from early Judaism and goes all the way you know up to Napoleon's time. And I stopped at Napoleon and the Congress of Vienna because I was just, I figured, well, I'm going to have to write a sequel. I can't go up to the present time like I thought I was going to. I tell you what, when I read the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that's when I said, okay, that answered a lot of questions to me. Mm-hmm. And it was also evident to me that I was going to have to extend my scope. I was going to have to go back to the Crusades and the Priory of Zion and get into the Roman times and also talk about Jesus.
Right, exactly. Well, Jeff, let's kind of dive into the meat here and break down what you've just said in terms of the fact that there is a different interlocking force both within Freemasonry and how this, of course, has nestled itself into some of the most powerful, it interlocked with some of the most powerful people in the Western world and in many other parts of the world as well. But let's go back and let's actually talk about some of that history that you have written about in the book and where we should begin. And I guess there is a real version, and then there's a kind of a mythological version that the Freemasons themselves kind of promote within the lodge. And as far as I understand it, many don't have a clear understanding of where it really comes from. I mean, it has, of course, a tie to some of the old, stone mason guilds and these kinds of things. But there is such a thing as what they call operative, Freemasonry, and then speculative Freemasonry, which basically speculative is what we see in the world today, because you don't have many stone masons out there today and building things, really. So break this down for us, and where should we begin to understand the roots of Freemasonry?
Okay. Albert Pike, one of the main thinkers in Freemasonry, any Freemason or any anti-Mason for that matter, will definitely have heard of Albert Pike. I'm sure you probably have.
Oh, yeah.
He mentions that the Freemasonry and also all secret societies in the West take from the Kabbalah, the Jewish Kabbalah, which the authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail describe. You can write books on the Kabbalah, but they describe it simply as occult Judaism. And very much that's what it is. Let me get into here. I can talk a little more about the Kabbalah. It can be considered a medieval and an early modern system of Jewish theosophy, mysticism, and thaumaturgy. That's the description of depiction of miracles. It's marked by a belief in creation through emanation and a Cypher method of interpreting scripture.
Was that Pike saying that?
Well, no. This is a description. Now, Pike said, Pike made the point that Freemasonry is comes from the Kabbalah. He's got a quote there that everybody uses. I put it in my book, but that's basically the gist of it.
Yep.
Comes from the Kabbalah. Now, a lot of people say Freemasonry goes back to the Egyptian times. And you can trace through the Kabbalah. Yeah, they talk about the goddess Isis and Osiris, and the destructive force in nature, Typhon, and this sort of thing. This all goes into ancient Egyptian religion, and sure enough, the Freemasonry picks up on that. It probably picks up on that through the Kabbalah. But the Kabbalah, is very important to Western secret societies and also to Freemasonry.
Let's talk about that for a little bit, because obviously this is a what they call the Judeo-Christian tradition is a very recent phenomenon. This idea that Eastern knowledge have been a foundation of Western. I really don't kind of by that, I see this, Jeff, as being an infiltration of an occult and an esoteric system into the West that practically is just built on Judaism or even some of the other kind of more Middle Eastern religions. But there is actually a quote by, I think it's Rabbi, I have it right here. It's Rabbi Isaac Weiss. He was a member of the B'nai B'rith. He wrote in the Israelite of America, I guess it was a magazine at the time. This is 1866. He said that Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end. Quite interesting.
Yes, that's true. And their ritual is the story of Hiram Abiff.
Yep.
And that's taken from, I believe, 1 Kings. All the Masonic ritual comes from the Hebrew Bible. The Christian Old Testament, and like I said, some of the occult Egyptian religion goes into Freemasonry through the Kabbalah and through the Hebrew Bible and stuff. An important thing we need to remember here, and as we tell the story, it's important. The Jews, since early times, have sort of fashioned themselves as an elite people, as a people chosen by God to lead, And this is very important to their religion, very important to their peoplehood. And the secret society of Freemasonry, controlled so much by Freemasonry, they pick up on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I want to talk a bit later about the establishment of Freemasonry in America. It's become very powerful there. I think, of course, it's very influential in Europe, so I'm not trying to downplay it there, but I think it's even more prominent in North America. But how did Freemasonry become such an important institution in the West? When did it begin to nestle its way in there?
Right. Okay. You're right. English-speaking countries, Anglo-Saxon countries, if you want to call them that, are very much influenced by Freemasonry, much more so than other parts of the West, other parts of Europe. You can't do anything in politics in this country unless you're a Freemason. Almost all of the Republican candidates for president this year were Freemasons. Cruz, Christie, Kasich, and also Trump. It's also influential in the Democratic Party, too. I know John Kerry is a Freemason. These things just, there's a conspiracy of silence. Nobody mentions that. That fact.
Yeah, it's true. Even Barack Obama, I remember it. He came out. He had this big Masonic dinner and stuff. It was, there was an inaugurational ball, I think, at the Key of Solomon or something like that in Washington D.C. Washington D.C. is just riddled, of course, with Masonic institutions and symbolism.
Right. Now, where are we going with this?
Let's back up. I'm jumping ahead a bit of myself here. But yeah, you were basically talking about, we're trying to get to the point of how Freemasonry became so infested, powerful in the West, and I guess in Europe in particular, if we go back a bit in time.
Right. Well, there's powerful Freemasons, as you mentioned, all over the world. In many parts of the world, Freemasonry is kind of elitist. Elite, powerful people belong to it. In the Anglo-Saxon, English-speaking world, it's more prevalent. You can go through a little town and you can see the Masonic Lodge, you know, in the town square and that sort of thing.
Yep.
It's not elitist or anything. But you know, so many people. Let's see. According to the year 2000 census, out of the world's 6 million Freemasons, I think 5.1 million lived in the United States. So that tells
you. Oh,
that
much? Wow. Here. All right.
Yes. So where did Freemasonry start? Okay.
It's a difficult question, isn't it? I mean, their own people don't know, right?
A lot of people don't know, but really it's not. I have studied this.
Right.
Freemasonry, there was two traditions that came out back in the 15th century. You had the Templar tradition that formed out of Scotland. You had Knights Templar, who a significant population of them moved to the wilds of Scotland after they were suppressed. They melded in with the population there, and you had this one William Sinclair build Roslyn Chapel back in the 14th century, and had a lot of Christian imagery inside the chapel, but there's also occult imagery, as well as you hear about this Celtic the Green Man. You may have heard of him.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Yeah, and then there was also Masonic imagery there as well. You had a carving of the apprentice, the young apprentice, and also the apprentice's mother. The apprentice was the son of a widow. I mean, there was a lot of obvious Masonic imagery there. So you had this tradition, this Templar tradition, start out of Scotland. And a development was the Scots Guard. Basically, the King of France had a battle, Battle of Verrieres, I think it was 1425. Now, he had a contingent of Scottish nobles who fought for him, and they did very well in battle, and he made them his Scots Guard and his Scots Bodyguard. And he institutionalized these people and made an institution out of their organization. And basically the second born of all these Scottish nobles, they would become part of the Scots Guard. Now, these Scots Guard, as time progressed, as the century progressed, they became part of an order of St. Michael in France. And the Order of St. Michael had a lot of Merovingian members in it, the Merovingian family. These were people. They were part of a secret society called the Priory of Zion, and they said they were related to the ancient Israelites. And the Priory of Zion, as a matter of fact, felt that they were related to Jesus.
Right.
They were crypto-Jews. A lot of you who've read the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, you're familiar with the story. But these Merovingians belonged to the Order of St. Michael, as well as the Scots Guard. They belonged to. And the Scots Guard introduced them to this Freemasonry that they were developing in Scotland. Basically, as you said earlier, they started with this operative Freemasonry. You had these stonemasons traveling throughout Europe. They worked on the huge cathedrals, the mm-hmm. beautiful cathedrals that were being made, and they were operative Masons. And basically, they were secretive. They had secret handshakes. There was secret knowledge, about how to work with stone and that sort of things. The Templars came up with an ingenious idea of just infiltrate these groups and make them speculative. Bring in
Not like a kind of a symbolic thing too, right? Of the idea of right. of constructing and building, that they're one of their deities that they call the great architect of the universe, that they somehow are representatives of this force, right?
Right, exactly. And the Templars brought in occultism and different types of mysticism. Some would say Luciferianism and also Satanism. You remember the Templars? They were suppressed. King Philip the Fair, King Philip the Fourth, and also Pope Clement the Fifth. They teamed up and they suppressed the Templars. The Templars had to leave. A very large population of them went to Scotland and melded in with the population, and then they formed they infiltrated the operative Masons, and they introduced speculative Masonry into the stone crafters.
Yep. Yep.
The French king formed the Scots Guard, and the Scots Guard joined the order. Now, this is convoluted now, but this is how it happened. They introduced this new form of masonry to the Merovingian families. The House of Guise was a very important French Merovingian family, and they decided they wanted to form their own Masonic tradition. Now you've had the Templar tradition that was the first. These Merovingians. Let's fast forward to Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon was on the British ambassador's staff in France. And he was in southern France, and he met up with a lot of these Merovingians, with a lot of these crypto Jews. He was tasked with the project of bringing Freemasonry to England. But it was not to be the Templar tradition. His tradition was called Zionist Rosicrucian Freemasonry. So now we have two traditions that started out in Freemasonry. We have the Templar tradition that started in Scotland, was brought to France, and then you have the Zionist Rosicrucian tradition that was brought from Francis Bacon founded it in England. And so you've got the two traditions. What can I say? We're skipping forward here to.
This really spreads at some point throughout Europe, and I would say, and here's where a lot of disagreements come into the picture. But there's talk of, the Illuminati and things like this, and by the time we reach the things like the American Revolution and the French Revolution, there are many things going on at the same time. But what I've been able to tell of it anyway is that you had an undercurrent and a tradition of, well, I guess we can call it traditional liberalism, right? An idea of, separating certain things or whatever. You had orders or groups such as the Nine Sisters Lodge in France, and they were in communication with many of the Masons that were over in North America trying to set things up and separate themselves from the British Empire there. But what seems to be an undercurrent throughout all of this, Jeff, is this very powerful, strong Masonic tradition that many of these influential people around, I guess we're in the 1700s now, but they were tied to Freemasonry and other types of secret societies, right?
Oh, yes. Like I said, we have these two Masonic traditions. You have the Templars and the Zionist Rosicrucians. Zionist coming from Priory of Zion. Some people call Templar Freemasonry French Freemasonry. Some people call Zionist Rosicrucian Freemasonry English Freemasonry. You also hear the terms ancient and moderns. The ancient tradition was the first tradition, the Templar tradition, and then the moderns, of course, were the Zionist Rosicrucians. There are two. In the beginning, there was two traditions in Freemasonry. Now, fast forward to the 18th century, you had two major revolutions in the 18th century. You had the American Revolution of the 1770s, and then, of course, you had the West's first mega revolution. That was the French Revolution. Freemasonry was very much involved in both of these revolutions. The American Revolution was basically a Templar revolution. Mm-hmm. The Templars were behind that. They were out of St. Andrew's Lodge in Boston. There, Boston was being the hotbed of revolution. St. John's was the English Lodge. They were loyalist. They were pro-English, of course. But the Templars, they were the ones behind the American Revolution. When the French Revolution started, basically the two traditions teamed up. And again, Freemasonry was a very big part of the French Revolution. Let's see, you had Father Buriel wrote a book, said the Templars behind the French Revolution. He wrote this in the late 18th century. Then you had a Professor John Robinson out of Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I have that book here.
Yes. Now he said yes, the Templars were involved, but the Priory was Zion, or let's see, what was it? Who did he say that?
You're thinking about the Jacobins, right?
Yes. But these were the two historians who wrote. They were contemporaries of the French Revolution, but they wrote about it. And both of them said Freemasonry was very much involved in the French Revolution.
Yeah, it was like that. This was known at the time, and then we've consequently just forgotten and put that under the rug, historically speaking. You know,
it's amazing. You can find Harvard professors writing histories of the American Revolution, and they hardly ever mention.
Yep, not a mention of it. Yep,
I mentioned and the American Revolution was all about Freemasonry.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you had, I guess it's the Grand Orient of France that was the the big organization behind, of course, the French. I don't know if it was called that at the time, yeah. Because you had the tie-in with the Jacobites there.
Yeah, there was different lodges there. Now, after the French Revolution, everybody came together. Templarism prevailed, and instead of having two traditions, they all formed under the Scottish Rite, and in 1801 you had the Templar Scottish Rite took over all of Freemasonry. If you read my book and you read more about the Priory of Zion, they are also a secret society. They are actually on top of the Templars. So actually, the Priory of Zion controlled the Scottish Rite Templars. The Grand Orient was in a very important lodge. Now, they also became part of the Scottish Rite in 1801 as well. But they were, like you said, indeed, very radical. You had a lot of Jews in the Grand Orient Lodge. They became very important in Central Europe and Russia. Like I said, they were very Jewish. I said that Judaism has always had a big part in Freemasonry, but I want to make a point here. It would be a real mistake to say that Freemasonry is a Jewish organization made up of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The lion's share of those people who call themselves Freemasons, they're Gentiles, and it is
right.
It's a Gentile organization. You could say it's there. It's the these. Jews, Gentile army, perhaps. You can maybe describe them as that. An important thing in my book now, you know, like I said, I go back to early Judaism because and the title of my book is actually Zion's Army, the subtitle being the Freemasonry. My book is about Freemasonry, but it's also about the Priory of Zion, and also about the Jews in Judaism. I make a point in my book, I was talking about two traditions in Freemasonry, the Templar and the Zionist Rosicrucian. I also add that there's two traditions in Judaism, and my book is one of the only books that brings this up. If you take your standard course in college on religion and you start to study Judaism, religion 101, and you start to study Judaism, you know, you'll hear about the rabbinic tradition. You know, that's modern Judaism. That's what developed into modern Judaism. But I talk about a second tradition in my book, and that is the Nazarene tradition, and these were people who were who supported the Davidic line of kings, the Jewish monarchy. They last actually ruled in when the Maccabees controlled Israel around 112 BC. But in Jesus's time, Jesus was the Davidic Messiah, and I bring that out in my book. It's important. I do not feel that Jesus was in any way divine. I don't feel he was the Son of God as the Christians do. I believe he was a historical figure, and he was, like I said, the Zion of this Davidic throne, part of the Zadokite priesthood. The Zadokite priest in Jesus's time was John the Baptist, and John didn't always go along with Jesus. But I also bring up two Jewish traditions. Now, when you fast forward to medieval times or the Dark Ages, you know, the rabbinic tradition, the Jews lived in their own communities. They lived in cities. They lived in ghettos. In Spain, you call them Juderias. Now, the Nazarenes were different. These rabbinic Jews, they believed in the Talmud, and they were strict as to what they would eat and what they would do, and they wouldn't live with Gentiles. Now, this Nazarene tradition was very different. They were mystically oriented in the Kabbalah, and they did live within the host communities of Europe, and they had no problem about getting involved in politics, in political intrigue, and this sort of thing. Around the time of the Crusades, a secret society formed called the Priory of Zion, and they became very influential in protecting Jesus's bloodline. Let me continue. Now, Jesus, like I said, was a mortal man. He was married. He was married to Mary Magdalene in the Bible.
Yep.
Mary Magdalene. We don't know exactly what happened to Jesus. He got in trouble with the Jewish authorities there in Israel. But Mary Magdalene was supposed to have left the Holy Land and ultimately to have settled in southern France. And she had children through Jesus. So Jesus' bloodline was transferred from the Holy Land into southern France.
Let me interject something here, Jeff, which is, I think, okay. It's interesting because it correlates with what you're talking about. We've had a researcher with us. It was a few years ago now, and we might not agree with some of the conclusions of the work, and I think neither would you. But Ralph Ellis, he's actually studied some of this, and it's quite interesting, okay, because he dovetails with some of this. I don't know if you heard of his work, but he basically looks at the work of, you know, other scholars and brings it together in such a way where he presents kind of a similar idea that basically Jesus and the family that he came from with Joseph and Mary and all these things were, they were not like poor peasants, that's what we're told to believe. These were actually royal families that were immensely wealthy and influential at the time. And it's, I think definitely there's something to that. He pinpointed that he was the king of Edessa, actually, which is, of course, an area owned or within Assyrian Greek, I think. There's, I definitely recommend you to look into some of his work because I think you can pull out quite a bit there if you haven't already. Ellis, definitely check that
Ralph
out.
Ralph Ellis, okay. Of course, I've taken from the Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is an important book. If you really want to get in this, you need to read that book. Also, a man named John Daniels wrote the book The Whore of Babylon and the Beast, I think it is called.
Right.
1,100 pages, but he really says a lot about it. But let me go a little farther. This bloodline made it into France, and they eventually intermarried with France's first royal family, the Merovingians, which I mentioned earlier. Now you got to understand, Jesus' bloodline comes from Jesus. Jesus was Jewish. This Jewish bloodline intermarries with the Merovingians, so they become Jewish. And one thing I might want to add about this second tradition, this Nazarene tradition, they also had a tendency towards crypto-Judaism, something called crypto-Judaism, being secret about their true religion. And these Merovingians, the Church of Rome was taking control of their area of Europe, and they had to be very secretive about their Israelite connections there. Their relations.
Well, there's certainly a lot to say about this stuff, specifically when you start going into the history, and there's just hundreds and hundreds of years to kind of wade through, and it's both tricky and difficult to do that in a short time here. But let's cover a few more things here before we take a break in another 10 or so. Or what should we know from this period? I mean, you talked about kind of a movement then of these basically powerful and rich and wealthy families. They make it possibly over to Europe. There's an establishment there of another kind of tradition. This eventually merges into Freemasonry. It starts to attract a lot of probably royals at the time and aristocrats and other influential kind of people. But what's the interface between that period and what we're seeing today in the world? Has this tradition just kept going and going throughout, and it's always been there as a force, or how do we explain that?
Right. Well, you have these Nazarene Jews. Mary Magdalene comes to France. She brings her bloodline with her. These secret Jews, they intermarry with the Merovingians, France's first kings. The Merovingians rule for two or three centuries. They were taken over by the Carolingians. The Carolingians was the dynasty after the Merovingians. These were people who were basically the mayors of the palace of the Merovingian courts. They were the people who actually did the ruling and did the governing, and the Merovingian dynasty became weak, and these Carolingians took over.
What time frame is this, just for people who don't know? What time?
Yeah, this was the Dark Ages. This was from the fall of Rome. The Merovingians ruled from like the fall of Rome. Merovi was the first Merovingian king to about 650.
Right. Wasn't at the time as well here? This is really when the Franks started to... There's, of course, a Christianization that occurs... And then there starts to be a lot of wars and fighting with other European tribes at this time, right?
Right. The Merovingians came from the Cascambian Franks, and they were a elite tribe there in that area, basically around the province of Lorraine in northern France. And They were that's where the Merovingians came from. Like I said, the Merovingians formed a relationship. It was Clovis, the first Merovingian king, who started a pact with the Bishop of Rome, or the Pope, as he was soon to be named. And the Merovingian dynasty was to be the preeminent dynasty in the West, and the Pope had made a pact with them. Now, the Merovingians, they didn't last. The Carolingians took over. So the Pope had to break this agreement he had with the Merovingians. And this caused a lot of angst, a lot of anger with the Merovingians, and it lasted for centuries and centuries, even lasts till today.
Right.
Because of this agreement that they had, that the Pope had with the initially had with the Merovingians, when the Carolingians took over, they felt like they were usurpers. They felt like they were interlopers. They were quick to marry Merovingian princesses. To make their reigns legitimate, and you've got to remember these Merovingian princesses were Israelites. They had Israelite blood in them. So in the Jewish religion, you know, the religious blood is conferred through the female line. If you have a Jewish mother, you're considered a Jew.
Right.
So these Carolingian princes who married Merovingian princesses, their offspring were Israelite. And this is how Jewish blood spread throughout European royalty. And it's true today.
That's interesting because, of course, a lot of these kings' royal lines, when they came in and when they started to establish and expand in the way they did, they started to bring in a monetary system which was quite different. They started to mint coins. Is that the right term? You mint coins, right?
Yes.
That's why we still have some of their faces on some of these coins. Actually, same thing happened in Sweden, and there was a I don't have to be too long-winded on this, but I just want to do it as a comparison to kind of same thing that happened there. I heard it from more of an amateur historian, to be honest, but he talked about the power struggle in Sweden, and he said that one of the lines that ended up battling for the power of Sweden was the son of an English merchant, where he had come from England, and he's the first one who started to mint coins in Sweden and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. They brought a completely different legal structure. They brought Christianity, and they brought monetary system with them. I just thought that was interesting. We had a very different way of life in Europe before this started, that ultimately then is a Middle Eastern kind of influence, right?
Yeah. I've heard of Salic law, around this time. And this was a legal system that had come from the Middle East, come from the Jews. It's interesting you mention coins and this sort of thing. Modern commerce began with the Knights Templar. They were supposed to
be the bankers, first bankers, right?
The first bankers, yeah. And that's an interesting group, the Knights Templar. And of course they evolved into the first Masonic tradition, the Templars.
Right, exactly. I mean, the myth, if you will, there, even that some Freemasons pick up on, is the fact that, you know, the Knights Templar is formulated in some regard. This is when the, mm-hmm. Crusades and all this kind of stuff is going on, and the Knights Templar, right. This is what they talk about, that somehow they perform some dig right under the Dome of the Rock. Something was discovered, they found something. And when they came back to Europe, they became immensely wealthy, and so much so that the Pope started to go after them, right?
No. There's so much speculation when you talk about secret societies, but this can't be disputed. This is historical fact. The Knights Templar suddenly became very wealthy.
Yeah.
And no one has really explained that. Well, you know, what happened?
Did they make a deal with somebody? Did they find something,
yeah,
right? We don't know.
It's interesting. Right. Well, the Holy Blood, Holy Girl, that they have a theory behind it, and it sounds really real. But we're talking about things in the remote past, and it's like you say, we don't really know. We can only speculate, and that's what's so frustrating about studying secret societies.
Yeah, and they don't share much information either, so it makes them that much more difficult.
They don't share much information. They're secretive, and a lot of their beginnings, they start in the remote past.
Yeah. Well, let's pick up and talk more about this. We're certainly just brushing the surface here. We definitely need to talk about the establishment of this in America, the Scottish Rite. There's a very interesting story there. Tons more to discuss, of course. But before we take a break, Jeff, give us the details. Tell us about your website. Where can people go to pick up a copy of Sion's Army, The Freemasons, which is the book we're talking about here?
Okay. Yeah. Just go to my website. It's got a real... easy to remember address, antifreemason.com. You can use a hyphen between the anti and the Freemason if you want, or you can take it out. You'll get to my site, whatever. But from there, you can get a link to Amazon and order my book. And I tell you, if you really want to get a good understanding at the beginning of Freemasonry and what it's all about, I suggest get ordering my book.
Yeah, very good. There's a lot of stuff to go through here and talk about. It's very interesting. I do want to actually spend some time talking about Germany later, too, and see what happened there and see what happened when the rise of National Socialism occurred and how they treated Freemasonry and why and whatnot. It's very interesting.
Sure.
But yeah, so lots to talk about. But yeah, definitely, folks, if you want to find out more, definitely check out Jeff Wilkerson's book, Sion's Army, The Freemasons. We'll have the links up on our website, so you can click through easily from ours. But yeah, thank you so much, Jeff. Looking forward to the next segment. Stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back after a short break. As we wrap up the first hour here with Jeff, I just want to let you know that we have a couple of guests upcoming here next. Tough Love from New Zealand on the degradation of art and how we can revive it and use it in the fight against the modern world. We have Vox Day and Cynic in Chief on the SJW list. Nathan Damigo from Identity Europa, Dr. Andrew Joyce from the Occidental Observer, and also on 314 later we have Arthur Kemp coming on, author of March of the Titans. As we proceed with Jeff Wilkerson here shortly, we discuss the various European revolutions, Freemasonry under National Socialism in Germany in the 1930s, and what Hitler's policy was on the Masons. We talk about the formulation of the Scottish Rite in America and the consequent anti-Masonic Party, one of the biggest third parties in American history. We discuss Oliver Cromwell and the Puritan Revolution, and later the Illuminati, the real society, not the nonsense that has bubbled up to the surface in recent years. And finally, we also get Jeff's take on what their goals truly are. You can tune in to the second hour at redicemembers.com. Go there to sign up for a membership with us and get access to all our content. That means all our previous shows in full, videos, inside episodes, older webcasts and TV shows, and now also the live shows that we have just started up. The members website is going to get an overhaul here too, by the way, so that's next up. All right, thank you so much. We'll continue with Jeff Wilkerson then. Second hour here coming right up. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back after a short break.